mean, I think Mark Twain said that travel is lethal to prejudice. You know, the extent to which you can walk in another person's shoes to see how hard people work and struggle on a daily basis, even for very little, and the extent to which you see how much people do, how well things are going.
Right.
I mean, I love showing up in places and thinking one thing and having those expectations turned on their heads all the time. You know, but then again, you know, I'm a fool. I think curiosity is a virtue.
People around the world still in shock over the death of Anthony Bourdain, who killed himself. He was 61 years old. We'll remember him with our own Evan Kleiman later in the show. First, we're going to talk about the effects of the new zero-tolerance border policy. Attorney General Jeff Sessions says everyone who crosses the border illegally will be prosecuted. And that's meant separating adults from their children after they cross. But that policy has not dissuaded people from trying to get into the United States. In fact, there are so many people trying to claim asylum, they are waiting for weeks on the other side in cities like Tijuana just for the chance to make their case. Meanwhile, ICE officers are deporting hundreds of undocumented immigrants from the U.S. to Tijuana every day. They're taken across the border and dropped off, and they're left to start a new life. So Tijuana is becoming a vast city of exiles. That's the title of a California Sunday Magazine piece reported by Daniel Duane, and he joins us now. Welcome.
Thanks for having me.
Can you describe the life of a man that you write about in your article? His name is Martin Soto.
Martin Soto is a guy whom I met in a shelter called Casa del Migrante, which is really one of the oldest and most established of the migrant shelters in Tijuana. It's run by a Catholic order. They provide a really wonderful service, which is they keep a bus at the border and, you know, and approach deportees as they arrive and also asylum seekers coming up from the south and say, do you need somewhere to stay tonight? Because people, you know, often will get deported into the city with nowhere to go. So I had gone to Casa del Migrante one day and was let in through a security gate and was just sitting in this concrete courtyard. That alone is quite an experience. And Martin Soto, he had lived in Los Angeles as a mechanic for many, many years and had a very rich life there and family and siblings and, you know, adult kids who are U.S. citizens and had almost gotten papers at one point and didn't at another point and had just, you know, one day been picked up outside his house and, you know, taken to the border. And so he found himself at Casa del Migrante in a city where he didn't know a soul, you know, with his whole extended family back in the States. And he had just immediately gone out walking the streets looking for work. And he's quite an accomplished auto mechanic. And he very quickly found work at a VW shop.
But he's one of, as you write, hundreds a month who are basically dumped in Tijuana and
yes,
left to fend for themselves and figure out a new life for themselves.
Yeah. I also heard a number of people talk about, you know, how hard it is to stop thinking about home and stop yearning for home. And I suspect that's a fairly universal experience of the banished, of the exiled, to yearn, you know, yearn for loved ones and yearn for familiar places and familiar faces and all of that.
Okay, so then you have the deportees, but then on the other end, you also have all of these migrants coming up from South and Central America, even from far, much further away, from Africa, from Haiti, and they're all knocking on the door at Tijuana. Why do they come to the border there at Tijuana, and do they think it's just an easier place to try to make their case for asylum?
There are very few places that, you know, a struggling asylum seeker, a refugee from, you know, some other part of the world, you know, can sort of walk up to a U.S. border, port of entry and ask for asylum. The story I heard from a number of different people went basically like this. Like a man from Cameroon told me a story that went like this. So fly into Ecuador and then start taking buses north toward Colombia. And then when you get to Colombia, there's one chunk of the Americas in which there is no through road. There's no the Pan-American Highway, as it were. I heard people from Guinea and from Haiti and a number of other places tell me that this was really the most terrifying part of the journey north, is that to cross this Darien Gap, they either have to pay a substantial fee for boat passage around it or just walk and try to hire a guide to make this this long walk through rainforest and sort of mountainous rainforest. It's unbelievably dangerous.
Why is it dangerous?
Large predators, as people describe to me. Bandits, though, of course. Steep slopes that are muddy, you know, no real trail to speak of. Navigating by scraps of cloth tied to trees.
Wow.
That and other migrants had tied to trees.
So there's this, I guess, this perilous journey, mm-hmm. and a long journey. And then once they get out of the rainforest, they still have to get through the rest of Central America and up to through Mexico, up to Tijuana. And then they're by no means guaranteed that they will be allowed in to plead their case for asylum.
Yeah, that's right. And I was really struck by how little many asylum seekers seem to know about the process. You know, they sort of arrived there with a, you know, in a spirit of like, I've heard this is doable and now I'm going to try to figure it out. I mean, the bravery of this is unbelievable and the desperation that must be driving people, you know, to face that kind of uncertainty. The basic story is that as a result of international treaties that came out of the Second World War, you know, when it emerged that the United States and other countries had turned away shiploads of Jews fleeing the Nazis and sent them back to die in the death camps, international treaties that were then enshrined in U.S. federal law guarantee the right to seek asylum, and there's a fairly simple process for it. The short version is that basically anybody who walks up to a U.S. border and says to Customs and Border Patrol officers, you know, I'm afraid of persecution at home, and by law must be given access to that system. They can't just be told to get lost. But in practice, it's not, you know, it's not so easy.
So when all these people make their way up and they're turned away at the border or they're waiting to be allowed in to make their case, what are they doing in Tijuana? What is an Eritrean doing in Tijuana?
Yeah, they don't speak Spanish. I mean, people learn, you know, human beings are awfully adaptive. One group that is adapting in really interesting ways to Tijuana life, it seemed to me, were Haitians. Many, many thousands of Haitians have arrived in Tijuana in the last couple of years. Very few of them had any real reasonable or viable way to get into the United States. And so they began to settle down. So now there are really substantial Haitian communities. You know, I got a plate of beef at an Argentine, you know, grilled steak stand where my Argentine steak in Tijuana was cooked entirely by Haitians.
That says a lot right there. Mm-hmm. Just that one sentence. Well, I want to thank you so much for your story and your reporting. It's really fascinating.
Thank you.
That's Daniel Duane. You can read his story in California Sunday Magazine. It's called City of Exiles. Now we're joined by Nicole Ramos. She's a Tijuana-based immigration attorney featured in that California Sunday Magazine piece. Thanks for being here.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Great to have you. Okay, so you work for an organization with two other women called Al Otro Lado, which means to the other side. And I understand you work with both deportees and asylum seekers. First, tell us about the asylum seekers. We've heard in the news that they're waiting there sometimes for weeks now trying to get an appointment just to seek asylum, just to claim asylum. Is that right?
That's correct. This has been a practice that has been ongoing with U.S. Customs and Border Protection for several years now, although this summer we are seeing increased numbers. And what is happening is CBP is consistently telling asylum seekers that approach the gate that they do not have the capacity to house them at that time and that they need to make contact with Mexican officials in order to get on a list in order to be processed by U.S. authorities. So what we have essentially is the U.S. government delegating processing authorities to a foreign government with its own terrible track record of human rights abuses.
Well, are you buying that there is no space and no ability to process asylum seekers, or do you think that this is a way to try to get people not to seek asylum, to basically turn around and go home?
I believe the capacity reason is a bold-faced lie, and I will tell you why for two reasons. The first reason, in 2014, when we experienced a sharp increase in migration from Central America, largely of them being unaccompanied children, the U.S. government had the ability to process those individuals en masse, and we're seeing numbers that do not come anywhere close to those numbers that we saw in 2014. And I have been documenting the practice of illegal turnaways, as we call them, of asylum seekers by CBP at this Tijuana port of entry since December of 2015. And so they've always had excuses as to why they could not process asylum seekers. Those excuses have evolved over time, beginning with they don't process asylum seekers at the port of entry, that you have to go to an embassy in your home country or the consulate, or they don't process certain kinds of asylum seekers. Or, you know, then we saw you have to get an appointment ticket from Mexico. And now we're seeing the excuse of, well, we don't have the capacity. And it's a bit incredible to believe that the U.S. government, which is the most powerful government on earth and arguably one of the wealthiest governments on earth, that has the ability to, you know, raise a base in a foreign country in which we're going to war in a matter of weeks, yet they are not able to process hundreds of refugees coming to our borders for protection.
And again, you're saying that this isn't necessarily new, that it was going on under the Obama administration as well?
Absolutely. The difference is that the officers that are dealing with these vulnerable individuals feel even more comfortable to let their xenophobic and racist and white nationalist rhetoric be on display. And they feel more comfortable in using abusive tactics and abusive language. What is also different under the Trump administration is this set policy of family separation. You have arguably Attorney General Sessions and DHS Secretary Nielsen saying, we are only going to separate people who are crossing the border illegally because that in itself is a criminal act. However, since May, at least, of last year was the first case that I documented, there have been hundreds of families that have presented at ports of entry who have then been forcibly separated from their parents. So when you know that, then the justification for the policy falls apart and reveals itself for what it is. It's a terror tactic designed to intimidate refugees from seeking the legal protection to which they're entitled to under U.S. federal law and international law.
They also say that this is a deterrent, that they're trying to send a message to people that you don't even try.
I see people that are so desperate to escape the violence and corruption, and those go hand in hand in the countries in which they're fleeing, that no policy will deter them. When you're fleeing for your life or you're trying to protect the lives of your children, as any parent would understand, you will do anything. You will sacrifice anything.
And again, Customs and Border Protection officers right there at the border, they are not the ones who make the determination whether or not a migrant fits that criteria.
They do not. However, they frequently attempt to do so, and in some cases, they do so. I mean, I've had cases where the individual had to be pulled off a plane because ICE and Border Patrol refused to hear them.
So they were put on a plane to be sent back to their home country, and because of your you coming in and saying, no, you can't do that, they actually were pulled off the plane?
Yes.
Wow. And then what happened to them?
They had credible fear interviews, to which they passed, and both of them are still in their asylum proceedings and continuing to go to their hearings.
And which countries were they from?
El Salvador. Mm-hmm. We're a small organization, and we've only been doing this full time for about 2 years, so we've had somewhere between 7 and 8 asylum wins.
7 and 8 out of how many applications?
We have approximately maybe 200 to 300 applications. We're a very shoestring operation, and we're 3 attorneys trying to do the work of maybe 10 to 20 attorneys.
Are there other attorneys there doing that work?
We have volunteer attorneys that come down to help periodically.
But there other organizations, or is it just yours?
In Tijuana, it is just ours.
That's it?
Yes.
Wow. So you are working 24/7.
I probably have not had a true day off in over 2 years.
Well, thank you for taking some time to speak with us on this important issue. I appreciate it.
Thank you for having us.
That's Nicole Ramos. She is one of the lawyers, one of the three lawyers at Al Otro Lado. Coming up, we remember Anthony Bourdain next on Press Play.
Introducing the KCRW donation car, designed to be recycled. This first-of-its-kind vehicle will save you time, space, and hassle by disappearing. Enjoy the luxury and comfort of turning your underused car into a donation worth hundreds, even thousands of dollars. The KCRW donation car, already in your garage, driveway, or on cinder blocks outside your house. Act now at kcrw.com/cars.
This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Anthony Bourdain was found dead today. The chef, TV host, and author died by suicide. He was 61 years old. Bourdain was in France when he died. He was working on an upcoming episode of his award-winning TV series, Parts Unknown. Here he is in an episode from 2016, where he's having a beer with President Obama in Hanoi.
I mean, I just wish that more Americans had passports. The extent to which you can see how other people live seems useful at worst and incredibly pleasurable and interesting at best.
Before becoming an international TV star, Bourdain was a cook, a chef, and before he was famous, he worked those tough 13-hour days on the line. In 1999, he sent an unsolicited article to The New Yorker. It was called Don't Eat Before Reading This. It turned into a book, and that book made him famous. Here's Evan Kleinman, the host of KCRW's Good Food.
The first time I realized that he existed was when I received an advanced copy of Kitchen Confidential at KCRW for the purposes of possibly interviewing him. It just happened that I was going out of town on a trip to Italy, so I grabbed the book and I took it with me on the plane, and I just devoured it on my way there, literally screaming with laughter with people staring at me on the flight for the next 11, 12 hours.
He was an incredible writer. I think people forget, they see him on TV, but his writing was extraordinary.
See, I think that that's who he was. To me, at the very core, he was this incredibly gifted commentator writer. And I think looking back at Kitchen Confidential, even with that book, he was reporting from this very demented place populated by misfits.
And he really shone the light on what happens behind the scenes for many of us. I mean, you, of course, knew that intimately. But for most of us, we had no idea what was going on in the kitchen.
That's true. And I think for those of us who did know, we didn't even know that people could ever want to know. I think we knew we were sort of marginalized. I mean, you know, I got a BA and MBA. When I decided to go work in the kitchen, my mother started crying. I mean, and I remember the first time he came to KCRW for me to interview him, and walking in the hallway on the way to the studio, he sort of picked up one of my arms and looked at my scars, like new and old, and he went, ah, a member of the club. He felt like such a quirky, weird outsider. There are those out there who still want to vilify him for what they see as validating very, very bad behavior in the kitchen, which, I mean, has been going on in every profession since the beginning of time towards women. But he always called those people meatheads and felt quite guilty that they sort of used him as a way to continue that behavior. As he matured and got older, I think he really regretted that he became the poster child for that type of macho stupidity.
Right, the kind of bad boy, macho guy, tatted up, doing drugs.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And I really feel that from the very beginning, what became evident in the TV shows, especially later, the last two iterations, is his compassion and empathy for people who aren't seen and who live their lives underneath some yoke of power.
What do you think he did for food? I mean, you talked about elevating marginalized culture. What did he do for cuisine?
At the beginning, when he was a young, more swaggering guy, both he and Andrew Zimmern and our own Jonathan Gold were giant omnivores who viewed putting something in their mouths that nobody else wanted to as sort of a test of their manhood. And because with Bourdain on the TV shows, he was always tying it to a culture, I think he made people look at it in a different way. I think it was a huge shift.
Yeah, he wrote in his memoir, "I know what I want. I want it all. I want to try everything once."
I mean, he did try everything once, often every kind of drug. And I think that experience of having such difficulty and using so many different drugs to try and cope was somehow transmuted to food. But ultimately, it seems that the pain was always there.
Did you have any idea that he was suffering from that kind of pain?
No. I mean, I think people who know him know that he's actually pretty shy and self-effacing. I don't pretend that I knew him well, but even I could see that. For me, another tragedy is that he was found by Chef Eric Ripert, one of his best friends, who's a deep Buddhist, whose whole life is sort of an expression of compassion. And for him, the fact that he couldn't reach Tony is just really sad.
I think we're all really sad today.
I would just say that groundbreaking episode of No Reservations, mm-hmm. when he and his crew were stranded in Beirut, when the Israeli-Lebanon conflict began.
Oh, right.
That episode turned into this weird, difficult-to-watch existential meditation on how hard it is to be in the world. And that, I think, freed him and revealed a side of him that just allowed his reporting to become more pointed, more idiosyncratic. And we're going to miss that. We're going to miss that voice.
That was Evan Kleiman, host of KCRW's Good Food. Here's Anthony Bourdain concluding his time in Beirut in 2006.
In the few years since I've started a travel-less world, I found myself changing. The cramped, cynical worldview of a man who'd only seen life through the narrow prism of the restaurant kitchen had altered. I'd been so many places, I'd met so many people from wildly divergent backgrounds, countries, and cultures. Everywhere I'd been, I'd been, as in Beirut, treated so well. I'd been the recipient of so many random acts of kindness from strangers. And I'd begun to think that no matter where I went or who I sat down with, that food and a few drinks seemed always to bring people together. That this planet was filled with basically good and decent people doing the best they could, if frequently under difficult circumstances. That the human animal was perhaps a better and nicer species than I'd once thought. I'd begun to believe that the dinner table was the great leveler, where people from opposite sides of the world could always sit down and talk and eat and drink, and if not solve all the world's problems, at least find for a time common ground. Now, I'm not so sure. Maybe the world's not like that at all. Maybe in the real world, the one without cameras and happy food and travel shows, everybody, the good and the bad together, are all crushed under the same terrible wheel. I hope, I really hope, I'm wrong about that.
All right. Coming up, second half of the show will be a lot more upbeat. We're going to review movies. We'll have a review of the female heist movie, Ocean's 8, Jodie Foster's Hotel Artemis, and Toni Collette's horror movie, Hereditary.
It is not gory and violent in the way that you may think of a horror movie. It's much more about elegant dread kind of throughout. And Toni Collette's performance is absolutely incredible.
Movie reviews next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm Madeline Brand. Time for movie reviews. April Wolf is here. She hosts the podcast Switchblade Sisters. Hey there.
Hi there.
And Tim Gerson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. Hello to you.
Hello.
Let's begin with a movie you saw, Tim. Ocean's 8, the all-female installment of the franchise starring, well, it's an all-star cast. Sandra Bullock, Cate Blanchett, Rihanna, Anne Hathaway.
If I were to be released, I would, I would just want the simple life. I just want to hold down a job, make some friends. You know, pay my bills.
Even if this was possible, you'd need 20 people.
7 people.
Why do you need to do this?
Because it's what I'm good at.
So Sandra Bullock's character there, she is Debbie Ocean, sister of Danny Ocean, George Clooney's character. And does she live up to the franchise?
Basically, this movie is fun. I wish it was a little more fun. The cast is so great.
I mean, Rihanna.
Rihanna, Anne Hathaway, Cate Blanchett. It's a really,
Awkwafina, too.
Awkwafina is in it. Helena Bonham Carter is in it. It's a really, really fun cast. And it's fun to see them doing another Ocean's movie. And if you like the Ocean's films, this does what those films also did. It's like a fun heist, putting the team together. Oh, there's some complications.
They all look good.
Oh, they look amazing. All the outfits in this movie are fabulous. The heist takes place at the Met Gala, so that is pretty fabulous in the film. You know, there's a certain kind of familiarity with these movies now that you're kind of, you sort of know the beats in a lot of ways, but the cast compensates in so many ways that it is a familiar ride, but I enjoyed it.
It's not Steven Soderbergh.
No, Gary Ross, who directed the first Hunger Games film, he co-wrote this, he directed this, and Gary Ross is not as stylish a filmmaker as Soderbergh, and that kind of hurts in certain ways. I wish Soderbergh could have made this film because I think it would have been better. It's good enough.
Good enough. Okay, moving on to another female powerhouse, Toni Collette, starring in horror movie Hereditary.
My mother was a very secretive and private woman.
It's Grandma. You know you were her favorite, right? Even when you were a little baby, she wouldn't let me feed you because she needed to feed you.
She was a very difficult woman, which maybe explains me.
I recognize you from your mother.
What? Sometimes I swear I can feel them in the room.
Okay, April, I guess that's not a good thing that she's in the room.
No.
A very, very bad thing.
There's a lot of bad things in general happening here consistently.
Tell us about the plot.
So we meet Annie, played by Toni Collette. She's the mother of this family, and she's grieving her own mother's death and is not very sure about how she should grieve because her mother's not a great woman. And what happens from there is things kind of spiral out of control. And you get the sense that these characters, their fate has been sealed decades ago, centuries ago. Maybe this family line. This is a movie whose lineage is in the Greek tragedies, I would say. You know, like you get maybe a grandparent somewhere went to see the Oracle and they're like, oh, things are going to get really, really bad there. And so this is kind of the culmination of all of it. It happens, you know, mostly in a single house, you know, out in the middle of nowhere. And it's beautiful production design, beautiful cinematography. And Toni Collette, oh my God, I'm sure Tim had something to say about Toni Collette too. He's just like nodding. But, you know, American movies, we get the sense that all actors have to play into quote unquote realism. Toni Collette here has a, you know, kind of goes into a different direction. She's amazing. She's a powerhouse.
Do you have something to say about her?
I mean, April said it perfectly. She's amazing in this movie. You know, I saw this movie at Sundance, and a lot of people since then, I gave it a rave review at the time, said, you know, horror movies, you have two camps of people. Like, I'm kind of a chicken when it comes to horror movies. Can I handle this? And then on the other side, you have kind of the hardcore horror addicts who are like, is it really that scary? Come on. To the first group, I would say, I think you can handle this because I think it is not gory and violent in the way that you may think of a horror movie. It's much more about elegant dread kind of throughout. And Toni Collette's performance is absolutely incredible. It's a film about grief in a lot of ways and struggling with family demons. And you so deeply care about this character and worry about what's happening to her. For the second group, the hardcore horror addicts, it is not a super, it's not a slasher film. It's not violent in that way, but I think it's one of the most intelligent, thoughtful, thought-provoking horror films in recent years. I mean, April does a podcast, so I defer to her on all of
this. Yeah, I would say the hardcore horror fans are going to like it, too, because there are enough. There's a great New York Times article about this, something about the disreputable pleasures of horror. Yeah. And there are enough of those, kind of the shock value moments.
The jump scares.
Yeah, well, not necessarily jump scares, but definitely shocking moments where the horror fans like me and, you know, some other folks, you know, they're still going to love it.
And I think what is really impressive also about Hereditary is that the movie starts slow. And there's a confidence that the movie has of, we've got you, you're in good hands, and you just kind of are just sort of enveloped almost immediately in this movie, and you don't know exactly where it's going, but you sort of just dread every single scene that happens. I'm a big fan of this movie.
Okay.
I think it's great.
Two thumbs up for dread. Finally, Jodie Foster is at the center of this thriller. It's called Hotel Artemis. It's about a hotel/hospital for criminals in future Los Angeles.
Easy, fellas. Everybody's going to get fixed up. Now, verify your memberships, and we're off to the races.
The Artemis is a secret hospital for criminals.
I thought you were done with all this.
I got out, but you know how it goes.
You're never out. Not up here.
I thought this place was a myth.
We've been here for 22 years. This hospital was built on two things. Trust. Rules.
Okay, Jodie Foster there. How is she in this movie, April?
I mean, Jodie Foster is always good. Even if, you know, the story around her doesn't really support her, she's still the shining bit of everything. You know, I think in my review I wrote just, like, you know, put her in extreme close-up and let her emote. Mm-hmm. And you've got a story there. I just actually wish that the story had focused more on her character. But there's an all-star cast here. Sterling K. Brown, Brian Tyree Henry. Sophia Boutella.
Jeff Goldblum.
Oh, my God. That's how many people are in this movie. Dave Bautista. And each one, I understand the Drew Pearce, the writer-director, I understand his impulse to make sure that each character has a full, rounded story. But sometimes those stories are competing too much with one another to make sense.
What is the plot, if there is one?
It's set in the year 2028 in downtown Los Angeles. The worst riot in LA history is going on. And the Hotel Artemis, from the outside, looks like an Art Deco rundown hotel. But in fact, as that clip said, it is actually a secret hospital for criminals. If you've been shot up in a bank heist, you go to the Hotel Artemis. Jodie Foster's character patches you up. A bunch of different things, as April was saying, sort of conspire in one crazy night where a bunch of people show up, including Jeff Goldblum, who's sort of this dangerous mobster character. Other characters who have also checked in that evening have stolen sort of a very special pen of his. He's also been shot up, but he also needs to get revenge against these other guys. Mm-hmm. So there's not supposed to be any, like, guns or violence in the Hotel Artemis. Spoiler alert, there's a lot of violence.
I'm shocked.
But not as much as I would have liked. I basically agree with April. The cast is so fun. I just kind of wish that the movie had been more interesting. It feels like it's based on a really cool graphic novel. It's not, because the movie feels condensed and sort of like truncated in a way where you don't get to know any of the characters very well. And so because of that, it's mostly actors wearing cool threads and saying cool things, but you don't really care much about what's happening in the movie.
Well, they are just fighting over a pen.
This is a very special pen. I don't want to ruin it, but it's a very, there are contents within the pen. They're okay. Very valuable.
Very special pen.
Special pen. You laugh now, Madeline, but if you saw this movie and don't, you would say, wow, that's a really special pen. I can see why everybody would be fighting over it.
Okay. Well, I have my own special pen.
You do. I can see it here. Yes. It's very nice.
Thank you. Tim Gerson, senior U.S. critic for Screen International. April Wolf hosts the podcast Switchblade Sisters. Thank you both.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, one more movie out this weekend, Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's a documentary about Mr. Rogers. I'll speak with the director, Morgan Neville, next on Press Play. This is Press Play. I'm KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand.
It's a beautiful day in this neighborhood, a beautiful day for a neighbor. Would you be mine? Could you be mine?
Mr. Rogers greeted millions of children with that gentle tune as he changed into his cardigan and sneakers. He did that for decades. With song, a few hand puppets, a trolley, and a good dose of make-believe, he taught kids to be good neighbors, of course. He also helped soothe their anxieties about some very adult things like the Vietnam War or 9/11. Well, this year marks the 50th anniversary of the debut of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, and a new documentary explores the impact Mr. Rogers had on generations of children and adults. It's called Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's directed by Morgan Neville, who joins me in the studio now. Hello.
Hi. How are you doing?
Hello, neighbor.
Hi.
You've made this movie over the course of the last year. And what was it like actually living in Mr. Rogers' world as you were making this movie? How did it
Let me just say, I didn't want to stop making the movie because there's something about working on a film about Mr. Rogers that influenced everything about the production itself. I mean, the editors, the producers, somehow we all were extra kind and neighborly, and it was our own little bubble we were in making this film, because every day we would watch episodes or watch clips and talk about it, and there was just so much positivity coming from what Fred had done in his work, Fred Rogers, that it was just deeply therapeutic, I guess.
Well, while you were watching all that footage and living with all that footage, were you remembering watching it as a child and what that was like?
The strange thing is, I was born in 1967. The show came on in 68. So I was like first generation Mr. Rogers fan, and I loved the show. But most of my memory of watching the show is more feelings and images than specific memories. And in fact, my relationship with the show predates my memory. Mm-hmm. And there's something about thinking about those things and thinking about Fred Rogers that makes you revisit a part of yourself that you probably haven't thought about in a very long time. So there's something so elemental about it that I just found really, really helpful.
I also found something mournful about it, too. And maybe it's the minor key in which he sings sometimes or plays the piano sometimes, but also as an adult watching this and feeling mournful for childhood, I suppose, lost childhood or innocence lost.
It's interesting because the thing he didn't do is just try and make kids happy.
Yeah.
You know, he played into the bittersweet rhythms of life. So he did whole weeks of episodes about death and divorce and bullying and war. I mean, this is for 2 to 6 year olds. And essentially, I think why he did that is he thought that the two great poles in our culture were love and fear. And he talked about love all the time, but he also talked about fear all the time. Daniel Striped Tiger, who's kind of the avatar for the young Fred Rogers, who was, you know, the most beloved character of the neighborhood, is a tame tiger who's trying to tame his fears. But what you see again and again is that Fred is trying to figure out what kids are afraid of and talk to them in honest, non-condescending terms about what those bad things are and how to process them. Because I think the adult instinct is to tell kids not to worry about things.
Yeah, or not to think about it.
Don't think about it.
This is an adult matter.
And of course kids think about it. So I think kids were so appreciative of that kind of honesty.
I want to play a little clip of tape of him as Daniel. And as you say, he was sort of his alter ego.
Sometimes I wonder if I'm a mistake. I'm not like anyone else I know. When I'm asleep or even awake, sometimes I get to dreaming that I'm just a fake. I'm not like anyone else.
So what you hear in that scene, which is such an amazing kind of touching scene, is Fred taking that idea to the next level, which is children feeling essentially like they may not belong in this world. I mean, it's really what he was trying to say with "you are special," which is his message that's so often misread. But essentially, he's not saying everybody's special and everybody's entitled. He's saying everybody has worth. And that's the insecurity that Daniel's expressing. And he's acknowledging that, but he's also helping children process it and hopefully understand that they do have a place.
If you're just joining me, I'm speaking with Morgan Neville. He's directed a new documentary called Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's about Fred Rogers, Mr. Rogers. So when he came up with this idea for a television show, he was a minister, right? A Presbyterian minister, or studying to be a minister?
Yeah. So he, in 1948, he was a senior in college. He went home for spring break. His parents had bought a television. It was one of the first televisions in the neighborhood. And by the end of that week, he discovered, one, that he hated television, and the second thing was that he was going to dedicate his life to going into television.
Even though he hated it.
Because he saw the great potential of it, but he thought it was so grossly misused. So instead of going to the seminary, he moved to New York and worked at NBC TV as a stagehand to figure out how television worked, and did that for years and became a floor manager at NBC. And then went back to Pittsburgh and started the first educational channel in the country there in Pittsburgh at WQED. So for him, it was always this powerful, powerful tool. So when he went back, he started a local kids show called Children's Corner that was kind of a precursor to Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. And while he was doing that, he did go to the seminary and finished his work there. And when he graduated from the Presbyterian Seminary, his certificate assigned his ministry as television. So I actually think he might be the first televangelist.
I was going to say, instead of being a televangelist to raise money or convert.
Well, and in fact, people. Fred turned down all money. He refused to make dolls or merchandise, anything, because to him it would pollute his relationship with a child who was watching the show. And what's interesting is that Fred was a minister, but he never talked about God on the show. I mean, it wasn't about religion. It was about this kind of humanist point of view he had. And it was something he got not just from his own faith, but by studying the world's religions. And he learned Hebrew and Greek, and he studied Buddhism and Judaism and Islam. I mean, he really wanted to learn what those common human ideas were that existed in all religions. And that was the thing that he was trying to really put out there.
And so he boiled it down to love, essentially.
Essentially, if you have to put it into a word, yeah. I mean, I talk about it as radical kindness is what I came up with, was my bumper sticker for it. But I actually feel like he might have talked about the idea of grace. He talked about grace a lot. And grace is defined in the Bible as the undeserved goodness bestowed upon you by God. It's the idea that God or one should do good to other people, whether or not they ask for it or whether or not you get anything back or even whether or not they deserve it. You still should be kind and good to other people.
You have a really interesting scene in your movie where he's going before a Senate committee, which is considering slashing funding for PBS. I guess Nixon wanted to zero out PBS.
Yeah, and PBS was only
one of a long line of politicians that wanted to do that.
Because PBS was only about a year, year and a half old at that point, and there was no—it was not given that PBS was going to succeed as an idea. And Fred Rogers came in to testify to the head of the committee, John Pastore, a very stern senator who was skeptical.
Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a lady, and a boy can be someday a man.
I think it's wonderful. I think it's wonderful. Looks like you just earned the $20 million.
So right then and there, he changed his mind?
Yeah, I mean, it's the ultimate kind of Mr. Rogers goes to Washington moment.
Well, he was a registered Republican, lifelong registered Republican. Did he see any contradiction in supporting politicians who were always trying to zero out funding for PBS or for politicians who may have not have acted in the ideals that he preached on TV?
Yeah, I mean, it was, again, a very different era, and he was a cultural Republican. He's from a very affluent family in Latrobe, Pennsylvania, and the one story I did hear from his son was that in the 1972 election, his
Nixon
son,
Nixon McGovern,
he went into the voting booth with his dad, his son told me, and that Fred voted for Benjamin Spock, who was running on an outside candidacy. That was the children's
the other
development.
Dr. Spock.
The other Dr. Spock, the kind of forward-thinking children's development doctor. So that says something about Fred, too. He's somebody who speaks to many different people in many different ways. I feel like most of us who watched him think of him not as somebody that has any cultural baggage, and we didn't watch him because we were secular or religious or liberal or conservative. You know, we didn't know those things when we watched him. So in a way, he speaks to something that I think is even deeper than those things we learn as we grow up. You know, it's kind of getting back to first principles.
Yeah. Another interesting moment in your movie is your interview with Francois Clemens. Mm-hmm. Officer Clemens, who plays Officer Clemens on the show, the police officer. He's black. And there's a scene where Mr. Rogers is washing his feet, and he invites Officer Clemens in to also wash his feet, share the same wading pool with him because it's hot and he wants to cool off. And he's making a statement about accepting other people during a time when black people weren't allowed to share a swimming pool with white people in many parts of the country.
Cool water on a hot day.
Well, thank you for your refreshments.
Oh, I'm
and
glad
so
you liked
it. That was, again, a radical, sort of a political act in a way, I think, but not politically stated.
Francois Clemens, he brings onto the show in the wake of Martin Luther King's assassination. And shortly thereafter, he does this episode where they share this footbath together. And it was exactly kind of what Fred was trying to do in this very subtle, really kind of loving way to show that for us to share a pool is completely unexceptional, that this is just how we should treat each other. This is how we're good neighbors. And again, to him, I don't think he thought of these things as liberal or conservative values. I think he saw them as human values. Mm-hmm. Like, essentially, we're just there to figure out how to love other people and how to love ourselves.
But at the same time, Francois Clemens is gay, and he and Fred Rogers says, you can't let that be known. Otherwise, we'll have to drop you from the show because the sponsors won't like it.
I mean, I know it was painful for Francois, and I think it was painful for Fred, too. There were a lot of times he had to check his values because of the show. And I think he believed that if he were to take a stand, whether it was to be openly pro-gay or openly religious or openly anti-war, that there were children that would feel alienated from the show. So he never wanted the show to take on those labels, even though they may be things he believed in. He just felt that the show had to remain neutral.
Mm. And then I guess later on, Francois Clemens, he comes to terms with that, right? Mm. And he says he thought of him as a father figure when he didn't really have one in his own life.
And what Francois' story echoes that I heard over and over is that Fred's real work was not on the television show. He would gravitate towards people that he felt were in need and did that again and again and again. You know, he got at one point more letters than anybody in America, and he responded to every letter he got. And to him, that was as important as his TV show.
Hmm. So his message of kindness and love, you think, has lasted?
Well, it's hard to look around the world and feel like he won, you know, if it's a battle between good and evil or between love and fear or whatever you want to say. However, I think of it more like for the millions of us that grew up watching him, he imparted something to us, and I think we're better people for it. I've had dozens of people come up and tell me personal anecdotes about what he meant to them in their lives. And I think that's the real legacy. The millions of us, he imparted a little bit of what he was about into. That's really what I kind of want to hold on to. And it's what I think the film ultimately wants to say, which is it's not about him. It's really about us. You know, what kind of neighborhood we're going to have is up to us at this point.
Morgan Neville, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you.
Morgan Neville is the director of the new movie, Won't You Be My Neighbor? It's in theaters now.
It's such a good feeling, a very good feeling, the feeling you know that I'll be back when the day is new, and I'll have more ideas for you, and you'll have things you'll want to talk about. I will too.
All right, Christian Bordahl, my neighbor.
It's a beautiful day in the neighborhood.
Sorry to say, there was no Mr. Rogers on Norwegian TV when I was growing up.
Really?
Yeah.
How did you learn to be a good neighbor?
Well, I'm not going to go there. But I did ask listeners if they watched, and 69% of them said yes, they watched all the time. Another 19% said sometimes. Only 4% said they weren't fans. 8% never got the chance to see the show. They'll have to go back and watch it.
or go see the documentary.
Yeah, exactly.
All right. Thank you, Christian Bordahl. Have a great weekend. That's it for our show. It's directed by Michelle Aloy and Sarah Sweeney, produced by Christian Bordahl, Amy Ta, Yael, Evan Orr, and Devin Schwartz. Quinn O'Toole is our managing producer. Mario Saavedra is our technical director. I'm Madeline Brand. We'll see you on Monday.